This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Andrew, I'd like to start with a question.
Okay.
I'd like to call Andrew Mason to the stand.
Okay. I plead the fifth, and I want my lawyer.
Andrew, is it true that 3 minutes ago we were having a conversation with our guest today, and you asked a very insightful question that was, what would make this episode a success for you? Is that true?
Yes, but...
Okay.
I think...
I would like to also...
Depends on where you go with this.
Andrew, are you on any other podcasts?
Yeah.
Do you manage any other podcasts?
I don't manage this one. So I manage a podcast.
Ah, and so you have actually brought up where I was going, which is, do you always ask these bomb-ass questions on your other podcasts, but then give us your leftovers?
No. I feel like the last time you were here, you had the exact same comment that my questions were too good. And so, ladies actually, and I want to call Jason Charnes at the stand.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'd like to point out that you cannot trust this witness because the last episode was an interview. The last one I was here for was the three of us. If this man's memory is like this, how can we trust anything he said today?
Well, my memory is not good, but what I would counter with is that you don't pay enough attention to me, and that makes me sad.
That is
because
true.
I'm actually kind of awesome, and I've been trying to tell you that. And every time I tell you that, you think it's a joke, and then you tell everyone else that I said that. But I just want you to like me, man.
Let me go through my...
This is going to be your defense in a real criminal trial.
Let's see here. Yesterday, 8:28 a.m., Jason... this is through the Podia Slack. Jason, I'm tilted. Why are they making a Matrix 5 nobody asked for?
Yes, that's real and true.
I responded, I haven't seen 1, 2, 3, or 4.
What?
There's thank you. Thank you.
Someone just committed a crime on the podcast.
Everyone's eyes on this recording just went up when you said that. Thank you.
I was actually talking to Harry and Mario, our coworkers, earlier, and I realized that I always look mad. And so this is how I decided I'm going to start keeping my resting face.
Resting mad face.
Resting mad face.
Don't I look so much happier and natural with my eyes open? All right, it's fine. We'll continue this another time.
He just glazed over the fact he'd never seen the Matrix.
It's pretty cool that we've pivoted to a true crime podcast, just like all the popular ones.
I have a huge list of movies I've never seen that people always judge me for. Oh, really? Because you're on your high horse over there. Like,
well, dude, I've never seen Harry Potter. I've never seen Lord of the Rings. I've never
seen...
What?
My parents didn't let me watch those movies as a kid. So there was a lot of movies that came out before I was like of age to be like, no, I do what I want, where I didn't see them.
And look what happened. Now you're addicted to South Park.
Yeah.
Jokes on them.
Yeah, I went all the way back on that.
Does your mom listen to this?
Sometimes.
And she hasn't given me a call. She knows how bad I want to meet her.
She reads my Twitter sometimes, and I know she reads my Twitter because nothing ever good comes of it. Like yesterday she texted me, or the day before she texted me out of nowhere, my sweet, handsome son, you have such a potty mouth. And then gave me like a speech. She's not wrong. We have a guest here. Can we stop doing whatever we're doing?
I try to get out of it, but then you accuse me of glazing over it.
All right. Today on the show, we are very excited and happy.
Why don't you start yelling? We've been having a very peaceful conversation.
Dude, I am being attacked. Okay, Ira, you see what's happening, right? He's attacking me, but not Chris, right? What's going on here? Ira, welcome to the show.
It's Jason. Always Jason.
Can you tell the people who you are, why you're famous?
First of all, I'm not famous at all. I'm grateful to you for calling me Ira. So my name is Ira Nazarova. And I'm the CEO of Evil Martians, which you might know from our Martian Chronicles blog or our open source or Ruby on Rails Docker, like a bunch of stuff we do in the community. And also Vova Dementiev, who's been, I think, speaking at 8 Rails conferences.
Literally everywhere.
Yeah.
I see him everywhere. I love it.
I'm excited to be here. And it's just a pleasure to hang out with you guys.
You said you moved to the U.S. recently. What area of the U.S.?
Yeah, I moved to San Francisco, and the exact area is called Back Heights. It's a super calm and chilled part of the city. I actually really like it here.
I've heard good things. I just watched a documentary about parts of San Francisco. So I know that the tech industry ruined San Francisco, and that's why all those buildings are vacant downtown. So shout out Facebook, I guess. Who's in San Francisco? They're the only ones I know.
Actually, there are some bigger companies returning, like renting offices. Of course, it's still super small. And I think like half of the downtown is empty, in fact, like the commercial property. And that's since the pandemic.
What's been like the biggest shock, like moving to the US? I mean, like you've been here all the time. I'm just curious what maybe shocked you after moving here.
Yeah, I actually made the first attempt to move to the United States back in 2015, and it didn't work out. But I lived for a year in California, first in Los Angeles and then in Palo Alto in Stanford. So this time it feels super relaxed compared to the last time when I was looking for a job and nobody wanted to talk to me. And of course, and this is different. So I'm not stressed. I feel good. What can I say? Like the shocking part is the windows in the building that can open up from below. I don't understand this. Why?
I recently learned, like obviously growing up in the States, I'm just used to opening windows that way. I recently learned that is not the way everyone opens windows or the way their windows are manufactured even.
Yeah. You can pull it down, right? I learned that not long ago. You can push it up, but usually you can pull the other one down.
Certain ones.
So, okay.
I once in college spent an entire winter wondering why it was so cold in my room, only when I move out to find out that the top window had been open and I had no idea because I had blinds there. And so like I heard my neighbors at night, like I'd lay in bed and think, God, these walls are thin. No, it's because the window was open.
You weren't getting bit by mosquitoes and stuff?
Of course I was. And it was
okay.
And it was so like hot in the summer because you know how humid it gets in the South. I'd say it's woof. Anyway, sorry. I can talk about windows in the Matrix all day. Anyway, when I saw you at Sensei, the first thing I was excited to say was congratulations for being invited to keynote at RailsConf, which has to be, in my mind, one of the highest honors someone could get. And subsequently, I think it's even, I don't even have the right word for it, but I think it's even more of an honor that it's with so many other valued people in our community as well. So yeah, congrats. And would love to hear how that came about.
It almost feels like cheating, but I'll explain. So I think one thing is Evil Martians, the whole team has been working for almost 20 years doing useful stuff in the community. And then I come and I sort of reap the benefits of that. I don't know. Sometimes it feels like that. So this is how your brain is like giving you all the different explanations of like why stuff is happening. So my other explanation is that it was just a marketing win from my end because I was thinking what the community or what the organizers would want to kind of hear. And I thought, and sort of from my perspective, right, I'd want to hear the stories of new startups, new companies building on Rails, growing, becoming successful, because I felt this was missing because we had stories about, well, kind of one-person framework, individual entrepreneurs. But then the pitch is one person to IPO, right? Then we have post-IPO companies or big companies like, of course, Shopify, GitHub, Intercom, like et cetera. But they chose Rails back in whatever, 2012, when it was... Anyway, they chose Rails when it was like a, kind of the most popular technology. But what about the new... Are there any new companies, new startups choosing Rails for some reason? And that's what I was thinking about. And that's what I proposed to talk about. And in reality, I didn't have the content like when I was submitting.
Who does?
Yeah, of course, right? I actually submitted just one talk and I wasn't sort of expecting much. Okay, the day everyone else got their emails that you're approved as a speaker at RailsConf, I got this email, but also Andy Kroll sent me a message saying, hey, we got to talk about the email I just put into your inbox. I thought he made a mistake and he's going to jump on a call and apologize and explain how this happened.
Oh, gosh. That's where my mind would go. I get it.
Yeah. But part of me was like, maybe it's something else. Then I jump in a call and he says, well, how about, do you want to keynote this?
I mean, it's well-deserved, A. B, it sounds like a super relevant and interesting topic. And without necessarily like giving away too much, would love to talk about that next. But also, you said something that I think is really important. for like submitting to conferences as a general rule. I've been thinking about like trying to like be a keynote. If you just thought, what would they want to hear? And what would I want to hear? And I think that's like just a really important thing to point out. Cause so many times, like when I first was submitting talks, I would submit like 5 or 6 and I was just pulling any idea that I could, not really thinking. If I went to a conference, what do I want to hear? I would just think, what do I know? Like, what can I talk about? And it's much like anything in life. If you like put yourself in someone else's shoes or their persona, you can make a much more meaningful, valuable thing for them.
It also helps that I've attended RailsConf last year. So it also helped. And then a bunch of other events. But I think being there, talking to people, kind of connecting with community, of course, helps you. I think it helps you kind of visualize certain people when you are then either drafting an article or like some content piece, or you're submitting a CFP. You have some people in mind to think about if they'd be interested in this. So this is helpful. If you just connected, you could say, well, I just connected to with 10 people, let's say, right? 10 people. What difference does it make? But the difference, I think, is that you have those 10 people sort of in your head when you are working on something for the community, and it kind of helps a lot. And then those people also, of course, I don't know, help like your tweets or something like that. So this is all something cool. So I'd say kind of attending the conference definitely was useful for submitting the CFP later.
So basically what I want to do is maybe talk about your talk without giving away any of the surprises. What are maybe some of the things you're excited to be talking about in the talk?
So this is interesting because this talk is not me. It's really the startups that I now talk to them, and I'm sort of channeling their stories, right? It's not me. And I've connected with a bunch of folks, but then one guy, so we just chatted a few days ago, he was like browsing the RailsConf agenda. He found my talk, he got interested, and he then found me and sent me the sort of schedule to the meeting. So because I have this kind of public link that you can find it on my Twitter. And then I joined the call and I realized that it's fully organic. I didn't reach out to him. So he is the founder of this WOP.com. It's like shop, but with W. And I just want to say, I'm excited to see teams that are building for the first time with Rails. Let's say they haven't been using Ruby for 10 years before. When you see someone who's maybe just finished college, I mean, it's obvious that this is the case. So they use Ruby, they've grown their team, they built on Rails. And what's exciting is they say, well, they were originally skeptical because they would want to use JavaScript in some way or form. Originally, maybe Next.js or maybe even server-side kind of Node.js application. So a few folks said that they switched to Rails when they realized they had to build so much stuff and so many integrations and stuff, and they switched to Rails from the kind of JS stack. It was like crazy how fast they were able to ship from that point on. And hearing this from somebody who's new to Rails in like 2024, this is important. This is what I sort of want to hear. And something I'm also excited about is taking their feedback, including the constructive feedback, like stuff that is missing for them. And I'll try to present it in a way to inspire the community to build the missing pieces, let's say. Because I want more people like that to be able to switch to Rails and like just experience the magic of Rails and experience and kind of help and grow their products with Rails.
It's tough. I think part of getting the benefits of using Rails, part of it is staying within the bounds of Rails, right? And like Rails is very much a server-side render as much as you can, but there are times when you gotta go out of the boundaries. And I don't know that necessarily we talk about going outside of those boundaries enough, because
I've made
a lot of mistakes doing that.
Yeah, I think maybe it's, we don't talk about that enough right now, because I don't know, back in 2018, 19, it was almost mainstream that you have Rails API and React. Now it's sort of went into, okay, let's try and do as much as possible with Rails full stack. But the reality of competing with other applications that sort of have React in their stack that have this super reactivity and super complex UI and stuff like this, this is what those companies have to deal with. They have to have this. And I spoke about this with Marco for a bit, with Marco Ralph, and he also said that, well, this is something that has to be sort of taken into account that, yeah, maybe you can use Hotwire stack or kind of Rails full stack as much as you can, but then there's got to be a way to add React, maybe for just this one page, maybe for email templates, by the way. People mention this often as...
We built our newsletter system on React. The actual sections that render are React components, and we server-side render them and send that HTML. So,
yep.
I mean, that's exactly the situation we were in. We talked on last week's episode, like we saw Matt Swanson frame, talking about Hotwire and framing it, or Turbo. They're all the same term to me. About like the best way to use it is progressive enhancement. You don't just go out of the gate trying to do that. And that's kind of how I feel like we ended up with React, is we tried to push as far as we could, and we don't particularly want to write all React. In fact, I have some troubles with React, and so does Andrew right now, but we needed to do it. And so it's not officially like any type of official guidance on how to kind of adopt that. And so, yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason I gave my talk.
And it's strange. I think we shouldn't have this kind of shame or guilt for this. It's technology choices, they change even if you think about it. Maybe in a couple of years, something will change and you also make another decision, but it shouldn't be shameful, definitely, to kind of use React. And I think we have this a little bit. People sort of feel left out when they use React and they don't feel supported in the community, which doesn't make sense to me. I think it's people should be supported. By the way, today we're going to have a call with the team at ThoughtBot that is developing Superglue.
Okay.
It's a new thing. I didn't really have a chance to look into it, but we'll chat. We'll just talk about their approach. But I think there are sort of two or three ways to integrate with React, right? You either have like a GraphQL API, because people want type safety in React. So that's the problem. So you either have like a GraphQL API, but then GraphQL is not the answer to all the problems. And also it's a beast like on its own. Not everybody wants it. And some folks that have GraphQL internally will still need a REST API for public API because, well, people are just more used to it and stuff. So they end up still having to have open API, schema validation, all of those problems. And I feel maybe there is a lack of sort of official guidance of how to do this. Like, how do you product in an efficient, productive manner, scalable, et cetera, ensure type safety for React in your API layer in Rails? And there's something we're going to be talking about this. We have this new open source product, Skooma, that might be the answer for many teams. But I'm still waiting for the author to write something about that. By the way, Chris said he made the kind of the rehearsal of his RubyConf Australia talk internally with his team. So I've done the same thing yesterday. So I went to our all hands and I presented like 20 slides, something that I had about this on this RailsConf talk, and immediately got some feedback. But also I was trying to convince the status of the author of Skooma to push it to the world, because I was trying to tell him that, look, this is what people are struggling with. So we should just talk about the different approaches. And then we have Superglue, which is, as far as I understand, you're not doing the API. It's still ERB based, but I cannot talk much about it. We'll chat with the authors today. So yeah, it's just that Rails and React, there has to be a productive way of integrating.
Let me ask you one quick question. Are you currently using one service for uptime monitoring, another service for error tracking, another service for status pages, and yet another service to monitor cron jobs and microservices? Paying for all of those separately may be costing you a lot of money. If you want to simplify your stack and lower those bills, it's time to check out Honey Badger. Honey Badger combines all of those services into one easy-to-use platform. It's everything you need to keep production healthy and your customers happy. Best of all, Honey Badger is free for small teams, and setup takes as little as 5 minutes. Get started today at honeybadger.io. That's www.honeybadger.io. honeybadger.io.
Something you said just now too was like 2017, that time frame. Like it was almost mainstream to do like Rails API, but like that's swinging the pendulum the complete other way. Cause then you're building a fully single page app. And I do think there's something really valuable about like just kind of like DHH used to call Simulus. I don't know if he still does like JavaScript sprinkles. Like it's almost like there is no such thing as like a sprinkle in a React component because they're big, but a similar mindset. So yeah, the tools like Superglue and even to an extent Inertia.js, I think are just like anybody who's trying to solve that problem. I'm interested in what they have to say.
True. I think in full disclosure, I've never even touched React myself, unfortunately.
Lucky. Lucky.
All right. Yeah. And
I think we were just talking about.
I'm sorry.
We were just talking about people not.
I'm struggling with a React error and I've been writing React for a month or two and I'm just like, oh my God, I want to go back to Rails.
I get it. My impression is that React is optimized productivity around data, kind of complex data updates, right? So if you have a complex data structure that has to be reactive and sort of quote unquote automatically updated, then should we reproduce this? Should we kind of rebuild this in Ruby stack? I'm still not sure. Of course, there's also the ecosystem and all the front end components and stuff. But it's a complicated sort of thing for complex data structures, I think. So I think this is how maybe we should think about React versus Rails full stack in terms of how complex the data has to be on the front end from that perspective.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, well, I was just thinking about GitHub's front end. It used to be pretty straightforward showing the files and whatever, but now they've got sidebars that you can pull out classes and methods and all that stuff and analyze like the file you're looking at. And they haven't had the smoothest transition as they're rewriting some of that UI from Vue component to React, but they're trying to embrace like a much more complex front end, I think, on the web. And it seems to be one that would be pretty tough to do without React or something like it. If you were to do that all in Stimulus controllers or something, it would be pretty interesting to try to wire up all those different interactions. But they're another one where it's like a massive company using React on the front end and Rails on the back end. And I'm sure there are tons of learnings and things, but that should not necessarily be like shamed for not being Hotwire. You know, it's important that we support that just as well as we do anything else. It's a feature of Rails to support the API or as an API only backend. So like for it to be, I don't know. It seems like in general, the sentiment is if you're not using Hotwire, you're not doing it right. And it shouldn't be that way. We should embrace this new interesting idea, but its purpose is different. It's kind of intended to simplify the front end. But if you have a naturally complex front end, like you're talking about, it may not be the right fit, but we shouldn't naysay it just because of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of value in simplifying things. And of course, this Rails full stack approach is kind of, I don't know, you have to think about simplifications and it's a good train of thought, right? It's a good idea to kind of, even if when you're designing the UI, you could think of, oh, how can I make it more simple and more clean? And it's a good motivation for the products, but it gets you a lot of products, especially B2B, especially internal tools, that's for sure, can be built with this approach in mind, with like Rails full stack, absolutely. And maybe more, right? It will continue innovating in this space. And I think what's community is doing is super exciting. Things like, I don't know, Flex, the Vue component. So Flex is another idea, right?
It's one of those where for us to move forward, we have to have people trying new things. Mm-hmm. And we should just support that in general. The idea might sound crazy to you because it doesn't help in your case, but that's fine. It could help other people. And we have to just try new stuff in order to figure out how to move forward and improve things. Because if we didn't, we might be stuck with how Rails was from 10 years ago or something, which would not be useful at all today as the needs of applications and customers want more interactive things or whatever, or we need to build more complicated things and so on. So it's just it's important that we support those people trying new things and embrace it that.
I just feel that the sort of vanilla Rails, it's a good, I don't know, even marketing idea, right? That everything is predefined, selected for you. You have this vanilla stack and it sort of can take you super far. But then in reality, much more complexity is needed, I think, in this space. So you need to be able to make decisions. You need to be able to choose from different tools. And it's okay. What I'm trying to say is it's not a problem. It shouldn't be one solution for all, because we're just building different things for the world. And just one solution can do it for all. So it's okay. That's what I'm trying to say. And another piece of feedback from those conversations is I'm still yet to kind of process it. This is the problem. I'm still in the process of how do I talk about this and stuff, but I can give you like the raw version. So one of the founders, several founders said something like, look, I look at into the kind of official documentation for Rails. And some of the best tools that I need are not mentioned there at all. And many of the best tools that I need are not mentioned in the sort of official resources. And it becomes a problem because for two reasons. Some of this stuff gets into the core, but too late, sort of years after, like Docker or Robocop. It's either too late sometimes or it's not there at all. And by the way, people mention, I was surprised. I didn't even know people noticed it that much, but because I talked to founders of startups, they are busy. Normally, they're not attending conferences because they're too busy building their stuff, but they still talk about Thruster and kind of mention this, that they're not sure if it's better than what exists on the market already.
Hold up. Somebody's got to explain what Thruster is.
Yeah.
Chris, you go.
As far as I understand it, it's kind of like assume the sort of typical setup of having like Nginx in front of your app serving SSL and static files and things fast, because Ruby is not fast at those things. Thruster will run in front of your Rails app and do those things for you. And it kind of came out of them building Campfire, it sounded like. But it's interesting where it's like, they haven't explained why not just use Nginx or Caddy or Traffic or whatever. And they're using Traffic in Camel. And it's like another one of those situations where like, okay, I don't know. It's out now and it will be a default thing in Rails 8, it sounds like. And we just don't have a ton of information on like, okay, what is this? Why does it exist versus using the alternatives and so on? And I've definitely felt that sentiment across things. Like David will talk about build authentication from scratch, but the community as a whole was use Devise or Clearance or something else. And the sort of the guides, the docs, none of it really explains like, here are your options for authentication. They just kind of gloss over that you'll have to build authentication. We got a few little things here, but they don't really like go to the extent of showing like, here are your options. And here's the way you could do it from scratch, which is what we offer as part of Rails. But there are some third-party, very popular ones that the Rails core team maintains, like Carlos maintains Devise. Mm-hmm. So like, it's not necessarily an official Rails project, but it's also an official Rails project in that sense, because one of the core team members maintains it. So you can trust that it will have the quality that you would expect from it or whatever. And it's been interesting. Like, where do you draw the line? Because on one hand, I understand from them maintaining the guides, if a project like Devise gets not abandoned, but like left behind, where Rails includes Turbo and Hotwire by default, but then Devise didn't get updated for it, then it's like, should it really be in the guides? And it's hard, I can understand, for them to maintain that stuff, because if you include in the guides, you probably need to make sure that like it is up to date. You don't want to be linking to things that are outdated or whatever you want to call that. But it is one of those things that it's kind of a lot of the community uses RSpec, but Rails officially endorses Minitest. And so how do you reconcile those? And it shouldn't be that like using RSpec is bad or whatever. And everybody wants to learn our spec because they see that in job postings all the time. And it's like, it would be nice to have more support of that, like in the Rails guides and whatnot, where it's like, we chose this and here's the reasons and here's the alternative. Lots of companies use it and just like show that, yeah, cool. It's interchangeable for a reason. If Rails didn't actually want to endorse or support any of that stuff, they could just say, Test Suite is in whatever we choose and you cannot replace it. But Active Record, you can swap out and all those features are configurable to be replacing ERB with Flex or HAML or whatever it is. So it would be nice, to your point, to see more of that. But I understand as a maintainer, it's probably like tough to...
Yeah.
To always keep that up to date if something went out of maintenance or something. So
yeah. Yeah. I'm nearly thinking of something like, I'm not expecting that from the core. I'm nearly thinking of doing something like another flavor of Rails that is more kind of designed for startups and
be interesting
for growing companies. Because it's a bit different. I mean, of course, when you have two or three engineers, you want them all to be full stack. And this is your limitation. And this is your limitation. And you can go really far with that. But probably you will not be introducing React or even maybe even RSpec. I mean, maybe even that was not necessary.
You just reminded me. I remember hearing several founders talking about like they want to use React because they know it'll be easier to hire people who are familiar with it over Hotwire. Because there's just a lot of people that know React. And it's interesting that you could... ship a, you know, here's our opinionated version of Rails that has the API backend and React front end. And if this is your interest as a startup founder that like, I'm conscious that I want to build an app that benefits from that. And I want to be able to hire from that talent pool or whatever, then cool. That would be an interesting sort of flavor of Rails. Kind of like with Jumpstart, we have some things like ES Build that we use. Mm-hmm. It could be like a version of that that has React and RSpec and a totally different flavor.
Yeah. Like the things you guys are doing with Jumpstart, with Hatchbox, they are all kind of related to this. Like you're giving people the stack, this kind of template and infrastructure for running Rails apps.
Yeah, we try to stick with the base Rails Hotwire stack, but think out a few of those things like payments and billing and accounts and invitations and teams and the things that I've done very wrong in the past. So hopefully we can save you the time and struggle of just the architecture of some basic core concepts of your app. And, you know, you got this cool business idea. I want to help you just work on that. Don't waste your time on payments or accounts and billing stuff. That is something you have to deal with at some point. But if we could do most of that for you and save you the time and effort, then you can focus on, you know, we haven't hit product market fit just yet, but we're getting close. And you could spend your time on that instead of like, I know that I've seen friends go through like Y Combinator and they end up getting customers that they sold, but then it's like, well, we got to do the billing manually in Stripe or something. And it just becomes like, they don't have the time to build that interface out or whatever and their own custom receipts and make it feel nice and white labeled like their company. And they're very busy trying to figure out how do we build a $1 billion company. And that is more iteration on the product itself than anything else. And it's easy to get distracted on those side quests, if you will.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned the kind of payments, billings. I'm now following kind of all the good news about startups on Rails. And I saw the guys, I never heard of them before, although it is an open source, kind of open core product. It's called Lego. So they do something like a replacement for Stripe, user-based billing. And they raised $2 million round, super successful and all that.
Yeah, I think they're a YC startup, I believe. I remember they got posted on Hacker News a few years ago and I was like, oh, that's a cool idea. And it was funny because they like support billing and stuff. And then you can still do your payments through Stripe. And I was like, that's confusing. Why wouldn't I just use Stripe billing? Yeah. But the flexibility of you are doing payments and it handles the billing. So you could swap it out from Stripe or PayPal or Braintree or whatever hopefully pretty easily. It's a really cool thing. And it's another one of the open core businesses, which I think is really nifty and neat, like Sidekick that Mike Burham built and GitLab and so on. There's like just a really interesting business model there that is, it's just cool. It's not been that many years where someone has been able to like, what if we give away the core product for free and open source, but we can still make money off of it? Like that seems like if you ask people about that 20 years ago, they'd be like, you're crazy.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's so hard to market developer facing products without open source in it. We're also growing a couple of products using the open core model. One of them is Image Proxy. So Image Proxy is used by Supabase in their image storage. And that's how we got connected to the founders of Supabase and stuff, because they wrote a super cool blog post about it, how they were choosing an image optimization tool, and they have all the benchmarks, and then they say, or Image Proxy is the best. And yeah, they run on the open source version, while folks like Medium.com, Dribbble, Substack, other kind of big companies, they run on the pro version, and because they kind of use the extended features, watermarks, and stuff like that. So it's a cool business model. Perhaps it's still easier. I don't know yet. I don't have like a final decision yet, but it feels that selling on-premise software to like medium-sized businesses is still a challenge. So bigger companies, enterprises, they all want on-prem. It's kind of natural, especially also companies in protected industries like healthcare, law, maybe governments. We sell a lot of like Anycable Pro licenses to folks like that because they want secure communication. And this isn't easy. So Anycable is like powering their chats, you know, real-time stuff. So protected industries and enterprises, this is where I see the case for like classic open core model where you sell licenses like Sidekick. By the way, Sidekick is cool because Sidekick is like almost everywhere. Like it has like enormous adoption. This is pretty cool. But selling licenses to kind of smaller and medium-sized businesses, this is still, I'm not sure, maybe you'd still be better off selling like SaaS.
Is it because I can assume a government healthcare company, like they're big enough where they've already done this and have probably a process to run stuff that they've bought in-house. Do you think the smaller businesses are like, don't necessarily have a process for doing that? And maybe is that why it's hard? Or
yeah, I think they have other options. So I think the main reason is that they can use SaaS, software as a service. And it's so much easier. It has this allure of, well, I just got the API key and I'm using the product already, versus, well, now I have to download what I'm saying for any cable. You need to kind of create a personal access token on GitHub, and a bunch of people stumble here. Anyway, it's like easy, right? It's a basic sort of stuff. You're all on GitHub. Anyway, so then you need to pull the Docker image from GitHub container registry. It's like relatively straightforward. And then you need to deploy or run your Docker container. But I'd say folks are familiar with Docker now in general. By the way, I'm pretty sure there's a huge amount of businesses and like kind of tech companies that are not using Docker still. Maybe we're in sort of a bubble where we think that everyone is around.
We don't use it at Podia.
Oh.
I mean, it's still got its warts of Ruby 3.3 doesn't run properly in Docker on certain systems, and Tailwind CSS blows up if I run it because there's an issue with Docker and Node that's been open since October or something. And it's like,
do you guys need, you're not using it for dev environments, or you're not using it for
I use it for years prior to joining Podia. And at CodeFund, we didn't use it either, but everywhere else, pretty much, like we started adopting it 2018, right when I graduated from college is when I first started using it.
It's not at the point where it's smooth enough yet to have everybody adopt it, but it's like gotten way better than it has. But it's still kind of like, you got to be a sort of a Linux expert to like write your own Docker file, because debugging that stuff becomes really hard.
Oh my God.
Which is, I think, the biggest leap for most people to move to Docker is, okay, I did this thing and then turns out there's file permission errors. I don't know what I did. And then you have to realize like, well, I ran this command in the Docker file and it was run as root. So then like the deploy user didn't get whatever. And you have to know probably more like, and Heroku has been great about shielding you from every little bit of that. And I think a lot of developers still want that. That's still the dream, is Docker could be invisible at some point. And I know there's tons and tons of people working towards that goal, but it seems easier said than done.
Containers are the answer, not Docker. Hot take. Containers, yeah, totally. Great. Docker. I tried to install Docker the other day to run GitHub Actions locally. I literally could not get it to run.
Yeah. It's an interesting one where it's like, the container is the thing. It doesn't have to be. And Docker is a business. Docker is not like the container is the concept, like the open source thing. And it's like Podman and these other versions that are like Docker compatible may be the thing that ends up winning in the long term or whatever. But because Docker was the one behind all the driving the change for such a long time, that just is synonymous or whatever with it. It's like you want a soda, people just say, I'll have a Coke or something. Like it's almost that level of association with soda or whatever. But it is, I think, a long ways from where it needs to be, where it needs to be a sort of like the Heroku build pack type thing where it's like, I want to run a Rails app. Okay, we'll figure it out for you as much as we can. And there may be some exceptions that you need to add, like whatever, headless Chrome to run Grover or something. Things that aren't necessarily defaults, but like that should just be a thing that's figured out. You check a box or something and, you know, it's done for you or whatever, ideally. But you can do a lot of that. It just takes a fair bit of manual setup, kind of like setting up CI, where you've got to edit that YAML file 50 times before you get it running correctly.
Don't get me re-pissed off, dude. I had some issue with that yesterday.
Triggered. Yeah. But that's all stuff that will be solved over time, though. Yeah. So currently it is not as smooth as it could be, but it's like all doable. And it's also probably helping people standardize in a way of deploying things in general or whatever, versus I'm sure there was a lot of cowboy coding in the past deploying two servers and just weird things that people configured just because they could.
Capistrano. So,
yeah. Well, it's like somebody puts files in Etsy, www, whatever, and then somebody puts files in like your home directory, or somebody else decides to put files in like opt whatever. And it's like, if I log into the server, I don't know where the PHP files that serve the site are unless I go checking these sort of common locations or find the right config file that says where the PHP site lives. At least with your Docker file, it's like it's in /rails or /app or something. Somewhere predefined, easy to see the exact steps that set up the image, which is good. So it's helped, I think, that where this knowledge is defined and written down in your Docker file versus like, yeah, Bob used to work here 10 years ago, set up the server, and we don't really know how it works, but we run the script and it deploys our stuff. That was very common in the past. Thankfully, it's not.
Yeah, this is what's making distribution of software in this form so hard, but it's definitely innovating and kind of changing. And what do you think? Like in 10 years, it's probably going to be solved.
But I hope so, yeah. 10 years is a long time, 10 years, but also a short time. So we'll see. I had a question for you. Do you think that you will see companies that want to do the open core model will maybe start with the open source and the on-premise and then eventually introduce the SaaS version of it, and they will end up offering like all three versions?
Yeah, it has a certain sense of completeness when you have a product in three forms: open source, on-prem, and SaaS. So I think we now have something like that for Anycable, where we have open source Anycable, we have on-premise and Anycable Pro, which is like optimized for clusters and stuff. And we now have like SaaS version, which right now it's like for smaller use cases, but I think it's kind of serves all types of customers if you think about this. So It doesn't mean that every product needs to serve all types of customers, of course. But if you think about Elastic, so folks had open source and SaaS, and they essentially, they weren't selling the on-prem to enterprises. And one of the complaints was that big organizations are running on Elastic, not paying a cent to it, almost like Apple or folks like that. And you could say, well, we're just focusing on the on this other type of users. Of course, this makes sense. But I think the bigger the company is, the more it needs to serve to different types of customers. And you start with either of those. I know folks, by the way, for example, they start with enterprises, but they do stuff like source available license, which means it's not really an open source, but the enterprise still feels safer somehow. So they're not doing any kind of engineer-driven growth. They just go to those enterprises, will sell to them, to their engineering managers or something. And that's why they don't need open source that much. I think open source is like driving adoption, right, among just engineers. So this is why you need open source. The main reason, everything else can be solved with source available, probably. I know folks that started as an open source company immediately realized that their product is kind of too easy to run on Vercel, something like that. And running it on, it's like a serverless Next.js thing. And you run it on Vercel, and there's no difference between this and SaaS now. But by the way, if you think about this, Vercel has something we've just discussed, right? That it was hard to run. It's hard to run on-prem. If you think about Vercel, of course, it's, you could say it's not a real kind of server side monolithic applications software, but it's like, it's making things really easy to run on the serverless infrastructure, and it's changing the dynamics a bit because many folks start with that. It's their default. For us, maybe it's not our default. It's something new. But for folks kind of starting their software engineering journey now, it's their default. And you could say they run stuff, right? It's just they click buttons. They're not dealing with Linux at all. And it's even easier than Heroku.
Yeah. The serverless functions use AWS Lambda behind the scenes. So a few weeks ago, I prototyped something just using Vercel's serverless functions with Ruby, and then eventually realized, okay, I'm going to actually have to turn this into a snot trap because I need to get a little bit more complicated. But like up until a certain point, I was like, this little rack app I'm running in Lambda works great. But we could keep talking forever, I feel like. But I think we need to start wrapping this up. Is there anything else you want to talk about or mention before we wrap a bow on this?
Just come attend the RailsConf this year. I think it's going to be exciting. And if you are in San Francisco, we are doing some meetups here. We've just hosted the first Ruby meetup here. It was really exciting. We had like 70 people at GitHub's headquarters, amazing speakers and stuff. So I'm actually planning to do another one, maybe after RailsConf.
Where can people find more about Evil Martians? Where can they find more about you?
Go to evilmartians.com. We have a newsletter. You can sign up for this newsletter to kind of get our content to your inbox. And you can follow Evil Martians on Twitter or me on Twitter. It's like I and my last name. Yeah, I'm just excited to be a part of this community. And I hope to meet more folks at RailsConf, maybe RailsWorld if we are lucky, and a bunch of other events. I'm still not sure. My plan is to try as much as I can to use Rails and Ruby events in the States as a way of sort of discovering the different parts of the United States.
You need to come to Arizona.
You need Jason to restart Southeast Ruby so you have an excuse to come to Tennessee.
Exactly, exactly.
That's a state you can miss. I'm just going to let you know. It's really, yeah. Anyway.
I need to go to Kentucky, though, how it compares to that.
Kentucky is cool. I've been to Kentucky. Yep. I said it. I said it.
The fried chicken there is to die for.
Absolutely. Literally, in some cases. All right.
Speaking of, are you headed to Popeyes now?
Dude, I mean, I'm really hungry, dude. 10 more minutes, I'm going to get angry. So great to see you again. Can't wait for everyone to see your talk. I know you're going to kill it. And you keep saying that you don't think you deserve it, but I do wholeheartedly think you deserve it. And I am very excited for everyone who gets to be there in attendance. So thank you so much for coming on the show. And we'll definitely have to have you back because I think we could have kept going for hours.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you in what, just over a month? It's a month away. RailsConf is flying, so I'm sure you have a lot to work to do on your keynote. Congratulations on that. We're very excited to see that and hang out in Detroit here in like 4 weeks.
True. Excited about that. And have a safe flight to Australia and back.
Yep. And then another flight to Detroit right afterwards. Looking forward to it. So, alrighty.